What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal tug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. And coming up, a victim of the evictions at 4 Mile in Port Moresby says the police actions were inhumane.
It must be honoured through a process by, you know, getting us a resettlement package, providing us land and, you know, getting us all those basic amenities correct before they do any eviction.
A court battle over the Commission of Inquiry report into Vanuatu's golden passport scheme starting to look inevitable, and Solomon Kings burst Auckland City's bubble in the OFC Pro League with a landmark win for the island teams. More on those stories later in Pacific Beat, which comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm Richard Hewitt. We start this morning, though, in Papua New Guinea, where the principal of Holy Rosary Primary School in Port Moresby says the recent evictions carried out by the police at the 4 Mile settlement in the National Capital District were acts of inhumanity. Stanley Tony was among those to be thrown out of their homes, and he claims that as many as 5,000 men, women and children have been left with nowhere to go. Now the head teacher is calling on local MPs and Governor Powers Parkop to step in and offer immediate assistance to those in need.
The policemen, they came in, 40 to 50 vehicles, they came in and they served the notice. And that was, in the notice that was served, it says 21 days of notice to vacate the area. However, the process was not been honored, and they just came in on the very first day, and they started evicting the people when the place was really wet and rainy. The number of people that were now currently being affected are 5,000, 4,000 to 5,000 people, with households being demolished, whatever that they have. Now, in here, for my works compound, it is now, it's backdated to three to four generations that we have lived here, we have resided here. And unfortunately, the eviction that took place gets very inhumane. And, according to humanitarian grounds, it must be honored through a process by, you know, getting us a resettlement package, providing us land and, you know, getting us all those basic amenities correct before they do any evictions. And in particular, right now, what the eviction that is taking place here, it is really not friendly. It's not really friendly to us. And therefore, currently, as I'm talking, the people are also removing their little bit of billion properties that they have. They are removing it. But they're doing it without focus, meaning that they don't know where to go. And that is where the school also commands. You know, the kids are also displaced, and the kids are kids. And, you know, every one of us, we're all traumatized.
How are the people coping since the eviction?
They're all confused. People are confused. They don't know where to go now. Some, you know, in such a place like a metropolitan city like that, you know, families, they live their life. They live their life independently. So we will become another obstacle. You see, we become another obstacle leaving our properties and going to them. You see, they can't accept us. So we live our own here, and then, people are now confused and they're traumatized. They don't actually know where to go.
Can you tell me what are some of the specific challenges that people are facing before or during the eviction process?
You know, some of the challenges that are faced by our current people here is, their lives are now, it's now becoming hopeless now. They don't know where to go. That's it. And they're left homeless. They're left homeless. And school children have mostly been affected. And likewise, we have elderly people who also are housed in the area where people are now, you know, shouldering them. They're now taking them out now. You know, all these things are now currently happening here at 4 Mile. So, our little livelihood, people are mostly depending on a little SME marketing and all the stuff to do the survival. Not everyone is employed. Some of us, we are involved in the public industry. We are working as a government public servant. And some are working with the the five assessors. But majority of the people are depending entirely on the little things that they do, SME, little house rents that they collect, you know, and the little stores that they put up, the little market stores that they put in. All these things are now going down to hassles, and currently it's really affecting the livelihood of the people. Currently, right now, it's now the third consecutive day of the eviction, and we did not get any assistance from anyone and anybody or any organization, nothing. We are still, you know, we are still left idle. Elected members that we were like, you know, depending that they should come and to assist us. There's nothing. Even our governor, entity governor, sent a delegation to come here. We are still waiting.
So what other steps can people take, or how can they, you know, seek support in terms of housing or improving, you know, what's happening right now to them?
Our little, you know, structures that we put up, it's all been demolished down to the ground. Yesterday we had somebody from Port Moresby Northeast. He came around and he promised us, he told us that there's going to be a land, available land that he will make it available to the office of the Port Moresby Northeast. Send it everyone here. We will get the database, get the household names, and then we will submit it to him. And he will survey and do us provide us with some, you know, assistance to providing us some land. But we're still waiting for the members of parliament, especially Honorable John Cowper and Honorable Lawyer Boy Samuel. He's also a member, and not forgetting our governor, Honorable Pablo Spaco. You know, as a public servant, you know, working here in Port Moresby, housing is, as we all know, housing is not a condition to employment. That is what, you know, it's an act that every one is, you know, facing that housing issue. With our little salaries that we earn, it cannot really assist us. So as for myself, after, you know, being in the department for the last 27 years, I actually did not sleep in one of those houses that are provided in the school. I am sleeping in a settlement here to provide the noble profession as teacher, and providing education for the young and upcoming generation, the leaders of tomorrow. We are concentrating, we are, you know, well committed, dedicated to what we are doing. But on the other side of the coin, you see, they should also think about our welfare, which is really a hindrance, which the government is not looking into that. There are also some other public servants who are also residing here, and you know, very big people who are residing here.
This will also impact the work for those that are working in private and government sectors, especially living in the 4 Mile settlement that were evicted.
People down at 2 Mile, when they have been affected, 800 children have been left non-attending schools, 800 students. And likewise here at 4 Mile, it is the same scenario. It's going to happen here. So it's the beginning of the year. We are now going into week two of schooling. I think our little kids here amounting to, you know, number into 1,000 plus students here. They will not be going to school. As I am talking right now, I am, you know, psychologically I'm traumatized. And I cannot perform. I'm a school leader, which I should be attending to school. But, you know, you go to work when the house is in order. And currently, as I'm speaking, I cannot go to work, leaving my families and leaving my people behind. Likewise, the school children are also, you know, they're also dependent, entirely dependent on the parents. And the parents, you know, when the homes are in order, then we should be, like, going to work and providing the good services to the government.
What would you like to appeal, whether to, you know, NGOs or local members?
Those are our leaders. Those are our leaders, and you know, that's common sense. That's common sense that they should, you know, come in to assist. It is now the third day, and we have not seen, we have not heard from them. People would like to see their faces, and would like to converse and have dialogue with them. And you know, their presence will give us courage, and you know, courage and confidence that they are thinking about our welfare and all the stuff. But it's not really happening here. I'm appealing to all my good families and victims, 10,000 plus victims who are now suffering here. That you know, get confidence, get over it, and we need to. You know, formalities will also take place. Members of parliament that we have elected them to come forward. Even the prime minister of the country need to come down to the roots here, to the roots level, because we are his people and we are in the heart out of Port Moresby, the metropolitan society of Papua New Guinea.
I wonder if the Prime Minister will make a visit. Pretty extraordinary state of affairs, but not unusual in Papua New Guinea. School principal Stanley Tony talking there to Godwin Eki on the line from Port Moresby. With Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia, I'm Richard Hewitt, and the opposition in Fiji is calling on Prime Minister Sitiveni Rambuka, in their words, to do the right thing and resign after a high court ruling found he had acted unlawfully. The court ruled Mr. Rambuka broke the law when he advised the president to sack the country's anti-corruption commissioner. The Prime Minister reacted to that decision by saying that he would appeal and stand down if he lost. But now he's abandoned that idea, stating he'll no longer challenge the court's ruling. So where do we go next? We get the view now from the opposition benches. We're joined by independent MP Johnny Osamate. Mr. Osamate, good morning. Welcome to Pacific Beat.
Morning. Thank you for the call.
So tell me, in your view and others sitting on the opposition benches, has the Prime Minister's position become untenable now?
Well, I mean, this is my view. I haven't talked to the other people on the opposition. But basically, the Prime Minister has surrendered. He has decided not to appeal. So he has officially, in a sense, admitted that he acted unlawfully and he broke the Constitution. And in a democracy, when you admit to an unconstitutional act of this magnitude, you don't keep your seat, you resign. So I think that would be the high road to take. And we'll have to see what he does.
He has, though, the support of his cabinet still, as I understand it. So that would tend to suggest that he doesn't have to go if he doesn't want to.
Well, that, of course, is a choice that he makes. If he's officially admitted that he's done something wrong. I know what happened in 2024. Under the former Prime Minister, there was just a verbal suggestion that he should stay away from a file, and he went to prison from that. In this case, there is no suggestion. We have a formal, documented, illegal dismissal of a constitutional. There's no verbal nudge here. So what we're saying is, why is this thing not being treated equally? There should be the investigation using Section 139 of the Constitution, abuse of office, and that needs to be implemented.
You referenced there clearly that the case of former Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama, who you served under as a minister on two occasions. Now, he was convicted of perverting the course of justice. He was also convicted of making an unwarranted demand with menace, two 12-month prison sentences, one suspended. So comparing that with what Sitiveni Rambuka now admits that he's done, you feel there should be similar repercussions?
Absolutely. I mean, in this case, he's admitted that he did something wrong constitutionally. He's not going to appeal because you know that he's wrong. That should be investigated. And if he took the moral high road, he would just resign because he's done something against the Constitution that he's supposed to live up to, that he's supposed to defend. And he's done the exact opposite.
So have you or would you urge the police to step in here? I mean, in essence, we're talking about the criminal matter.
No. That's what I'm saying. If you know that something, everybody should be treated in the same way. If people have been mending with our laws, meddling with FICAC, bypassing the Judicial Services Commission, it needs to be taken to task. Everybody needs to be treated equally. And I think that is fundamental in any country in the world, and I think it's very important in Fiji.
So police intervention would be one thing. Another possibility would be for you and members of the opposition to get together and table a vote of no confidence. Now, as it stands, the numbers, I think, are against you. But from what you're saying, you would clearly suggest that some members of the government need to look to their conscience.
They need to do that. They need to do that. We don't have the numbers. And, of course, the gentlemanly way out is to do the right thing. You know that you've done something, that take the moral high ground. When you've gone against the Constitution that you are supposed to be there to defend, one should resign. And if not, the powers that be, the director of the public prosecution, whoever it is, they need to investigate the case, find the case and put it before the courts, and let then the court make its decision.
And where do you think this leaves FICAC, which is at the center of all this, of course, in the way that was being run and the removal of the commissioner? I mean, has that body essentially also become untenable in some ways? I mean, how can it continue to function against this background?
I think all of the things that are happening here is weakening FICAC. And FICAC has a very important role in terms of corruption. And the people that lead this country must make sure that they protect it to make sure that it can carry out its role. And if we do anything that diminishes the ability of FICAC to carry its role, then we are not contributing to the development of our country. We're not protecting our country. The leadership that is in place now must make sure that they protect FICAC. That's not its role. And if there are things that are going on in FICAC, this is my own opinion, it needs to be cleaned up so that FICAC can carry out its role impartially, objectively, in the best interests of the country.
Long term, in terms of the political future in Fiji, I mean, a situation like this could open doors, couldn't it? I mean, you were a member, of course, of the party under Frank Bainimarama, and in the end, that party effectively broke up after the last election, and hence the reason you're now an independent. But could you see the party reinventing itself and taking advantage of this political situation?
Oh, no. That party is gone. People First. Fiji First is no more. I mean, I'm now a member of a group that has set up a new party, and the new party will be looking to learn from the mistakes of the past and make amendments and change and present a better alternative for the people of this country the next time elections come around.
So to some degree, would it be fair to say that you've been lying in wait, really, waiting for something like this, waiting for the Prime Minister is a huge mistake?
We are the opposition. We are always the alternative government. So we always present ourselves as the alternative government, and we are, in fact, the alternative government.
And to come back to our main point, I mean, you've made it very clear that you think the Prime Minister should go. If he doesn't, beyond a vote of no confidence, what else can you and fellow opposition MPs do?
What can you do? We can just keep raising it, and it's up to them at the end of the day what they do. Well, you don't have the numbers in Parliament. He has the option of taking the moral high ground or not. The party, the organizations and institutions in government that are supposed to investigate breaches of the law have the opportunity to do so. And if they do not do that, then that is another worrisome thing again for the future of this country.
What if the Prime Minister were essentially to stand before the public of Fiji and say, yes, this is what I did, I was wrong, I'm asking for forgiveness? I don't know whether he would do anything like that, but if he did, how would you feel about that?
He has already admitted that he is at fault, and he already said that he didn't listen to any advice. He's already done that. The law then needs to take its course. That's the point. That's my point of view.
So what happens next as far as you're concerned? You said that you're expressing your personal opinions here, but I presume now there has to be some dialogue between yourself, fellow independents, and members of the opposition to decide where you go next.
Yes, of course. And I'm currently not in Suva, I'm on a committee business around the country, presenting three bills. But I think, as you said, that is something that the members of the opposition will have to consider and talk about.
And clearly, this is not a matter that you and others are going to let go. I mean, you're going to pursue this with every ounce of political might that you have.
This is a serious matter. It is a leader of a country going against the very constitution that he swore his oath on. I mean, there are other countries in the world where similar things are happening. And it's not something that anybody should let go of. Because you're talking about good governance. You're talking about the future of the rule of law and order. No leader in his right mind will let it go, because the ramifications down into the future will be huge, and will be very, very bad for the future of our country.
We'll leave it there. No doubt further developments not too far away. We very much appreciate your time on the program this morning. Thank you for joining
us. Thank you.
Pacific.
You have a great day today. Vanaka.
Vanaka. Johnny Osumate there, independent MP, was a member of Fiji First, the government under Frank Bainimarama, served in two ministerial roles, and now I suspect all of the opposition MPs will be lining up to suggest that the time is up for Mr. Rambuka as Prime Minister of Fiji.
Want the latest Pacific Rugby League and Union news and interviews with stars of the game? Tune in to Nation Footy with Sam Wykes and Tinirau Arona.
Well, do you reckon just on that one, I could get a gig with your commentary?
I know. You know what? I have to get you to say the names first. Say the names first. So you get the pronunciations right, you're in.
The numbers in, mate.
You're
Nation
in.
Footy, Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
With Pacific Beats for a Monday morning or a Sunday if you're still on the other side of the dateline. So maybe feed up rather than preparing for work, if that's the case. Cook Islands, for example, American Samoa. Going to carry on the political theme now and take a look at what's happening in Vanuatu, where a battle over the findings of a commission inquiry report into that country's golden passport scheme appears to be heading inevitably to the courts. A government announcement signalling two new commissions into the controversial issue has failed to appease the opposition. Ministers are arguing that the 2024 inquiry went beyond its terms of reference, but critics say the report is simply being kept from the public deliberately. Opposition MP Andrew Wilbert Napat says trust in the government is eroding rapidly, and taking matters to court would seem to be the only option now.
As an opposition MP and a new elected member of parliament for Vanuatu, I am calling for transparency and accountability for all the leaders of Vanuatu in the opposition and the government side. because the message that we preach to the people during the campaign is transparency and accountability. And this issue of COI doesn't reflect what we preach during our campaign.
So the government has said there are legal reasons behind why they don't want to release the report to public. What do you think is the reason why the government doesn't want to release that report?
The reasons they are hanging on is the terms of reference of the COI, which no one knows which part of the terms of reference are they referring to. Because the fact is, the terms of reference for the current COI is correct. And the government needs to be very clear and transparent with the crowns, which up till today, no one knows except a few of the MPs in the government. I think there are real reasons behind this, which the government is not transparent about. There's serious allegations.
So we have recently spoken to government spokesperson Kerry Manase, and he said the government believes that the 2024 Commission of Inquiry was selective and that the commission was politically motivated in its investigation, and that's why they are going ahead with a second commission of inquiry into the citizenship program and another one into the diplomatic passport. What do you think of that?
There are no crowns on these kinds of allegations from the government. The minister who was responsible for the COI that year is a member of the party of the current prime minister. I don't understand why he would say such things as politically motivated. And to frankly say that the COI executives at that time, they are pretty much independent people. And some of them were former police officers. And I think that is pretty much a good grounds to base on in selecting the members who carry out the COI investigations.
How can the public trust outcome of this new commission of inquiry when the government refuses to release findings from the 2024 inquiry?
I think the whole country has lost trust on the current government already because of the current COI. And withholding the current COI report might trigger something that the nation might not expect. Raiding another COI is just another way of government trying to withhold this report from the public, and it's causing a lot of tension among the public right now. So the way forward is for the government to release the current COI to ease up the tensions. If the current government doesn't release the current COI, it will make people more suspicious, and that means that people will lose trust on the government and any other information from any new COI. People won't even take it. So I think the way forward is for the government to release the current COI so that people will still keep the trust and confidence in the government.
What's the next step that the opposition is taking in terms of getting the government to release the 2024 Commission of Inquiry report?
I think the way forward for the opposition now is to take the issue to court. And I think that's the only option that the opposition have right now. So the court will decide on whether the government should release the COI report or not.
And so the saga continues. Opposition MP Andrew Wilbur Napat, who happens to be the brother of Andrew Napat, Vanuatu's Internal Affairs Minister. Andrew Wilbur was speaking there to Pacific Beat Slayer Lonebo.
Want to catch up or listen again to your favourite ABC Radio Australia programs anytime, anywhere? From Pacific Beat to Stories from the Pacific, Nisian Footy to Culture Compass. You can listen to your top shows on your favourite podcast app on the go and for free. Just search for your favourite ABC Radio Australia program in your podcast app and press play. ABC Radio Australia, bringing you more ways to listen.
Start of another week here on Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. Richard Hewitt with you sitting in for Aggie Tupou, who I believe will be back in this chair tomorrow. Now, after two rounds of the OFC Pro League, Auckland City are clear at the top of the ladder, but their air of invincibility has gone now after their winning streak was brought to an end by the Solomon Kings. The Kings won the match 3-1 to move to third on the ladder, and they're now the only island team in the top four. PNG Hikari are still without a win, and a coach for that matter, after going down 2-1 to South Island United. Tahiti United are off the mark after they defeated Buller FC 1-0. And South Melbourne hammered Vanuatu United 5-2. Hardly surprising, really, after Vanuatu had three players sent off and their coach Lars Hopp was also red-carded. So quite a weekend in Port Moresby as the second circuit of the Pro League came to an end. Joining us now to offer his thoughts on the Pro League actions, former PNG international player and former Football Australia Chief of Staff, Alex Devani. Alex, good morning. Welcome to Pacific Beats.
Good morning, Richard. Great to join you this morning.
It was quite a weekend, but that result, Solomon Kings defeating Auckland City by 3-1, is an absolute standout, I would suggest, because it demonstrates that the gap between the island teams and arguably the best team in the competition is not as great as perhaps we thought it was.
Yeah, I think so, Richard. I mean, what we've seen between round one and round two has been a significant improvement in just the way the teams outside of, you know, South Melbourne, Auckland FC and South Island are organised. The fitness has improved and the quality of football has been excellent. So I wasn't surprised when the Solomon Kings did the job against Auckland. They've been excellent these two rounds. They've recruited well. They've got a good combination, a good solid foundation of Solomon Island players, and have recruited well from Australia. So it was an excellent match, Richard. So I'm not too surprised. But you know, there is a long way to go for some of the teams, but very impressive indeed.
It has to be encouraging, though, for those people who are making judgments very early on in the piece and saying, well, there is this gap between the island teams and the two New Zealand teams, the Australian side. Well, maybe the gap isn't as great as we thought it was. And as you say, I mean, the competition is in such an early stage that the Pacific Island teams in particular are still learning about being professional.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But they've adjusted really well, Richard. As I said, I think I've certainly seen significant improvement. Ball was exceptional. I think teams like Vanuatu are a bit unlucky not to be a little bit higher on the table. Really well organized. Again, recruited extremely well. Solid foundation of players from Vanuatu. And a little bit unlucky not to be a little bit higher up the table because the football's been excellent. The technical quality is improving every game. The manner in which the matches are played, the structure of the competition, it is difficult. You know, it's a few matches in 7 days, so it is a little bit difficult on the players, I think, especially in the humid conditions of Port Moresby. I was certainly glad not to be on the pitch, but the players have adjusted really well, and I think we are now starting to see that quality from the players in the islands come through. You know, with a little bit of guidance, a little bit of structure, and an opportunity, our players always stand out, and something, you know, we've spoken about often, Richard.
One thing we've seen in the competition up to now, and we've had six rounds of matches over two circuits, is generally speaking, players have been pretty disciplined. So I'm wondering what on earth happened to Vanuatu United to have three players sent off and their coach ordered away from the field as well. It may bring into question perhaps the officiating. Maybe the referees were a little bit overzealous. What's your view?
Look, it's the end of the circuit. I think, you know, they've played two or three matches by that point. And players get tired. Staff gets tired. And when you're tired, you make decisions you wouldn't ordinarily make. So I put it down to that. I think the officiating has also been pretty good, Richard. you know, all in all, I think the quality of the officiating, the match play, and the discipline of the players has been pretty good. Every now and then you just get a match like this, you know, heat of the moment. The players have been giving everything. So I think it's just one of those moments where, you know, players and staff lose their cool. But it's certainly not indicative of the matches so far.
I have to ask you about PNG Hikari, bottom of the ladder, yet to win a game. Their coach left, apparently for personal reasons, but has since suggested that there was a lot more to it than that, and he wasn't very happy about the way things were being run. He wasn't having a say in team selection. Something seems to have gone pretty badly wrong behind the scenes for PNG's team, and yet Hikari were an established team, or an established organisation at least, before this competition.
Yeah, and I think it just shows, Richard, how serious this competition is being taken by all the nations and all the teams participating in this competition. You know, Hikari were an established side. The other teams are relatively new, so had to go out, had to recruit aggressively, both players and coaching staff. I've seen enough from Hikari to believe that they probably have deserved a little bit more from a few of the matches. You know, I think equalized in the last couple of minutes against Vanuatu, had two goals scored against them in the 92nd and 94th minute against Auckland. So they have been a little bit lucky, Richard, and because the competition's been excellent, Hikari haven't been too far off. I think in the next round they'll really come to the fore.
And just winding the clock back a little, you were Football Australia's chief of staff at the point where.
Yes.
The league was being, as it were, put together, and it was being worked out how it would operate. And you were, of course, instrumental in the fact that there's an Australian team taking part in South Melbourne. But as things have turned out, is this the vision that you had? Is this the pro league that you thought it would be?
Yeah, in many ways, Richard. You know, I'm very optimistic about the pro league, seeing an historic club like South and their colours. In the Pacific again is a really, really nice thing to see. I think the football's been excellent. You know, like with any new competition, new sporting product, it will take time to build connection. And towards the back end of the circuit in Port Moresby, you know, we started to see teams getting out to schools and the competition involving the community in Port Moresby directly, but also many of, you know, the diaspora across the Pacific Islands that live in Port Moresby as well. So that was really nice to see. I'm really excited about the competition, Richard, and really proud of what OFC and the other member associations across Oceania have been able to put together. It's been great, Richard. Very optimistic about it.
And for those people who have been asking on social media, why is there an Australian team in an OFC competition? Can you give us a quick answer?
Well, while at Football Australia, the request actually came from OFC. You know, Australia was one of the founding nations of the Oceania Football Confederation. So we've had Australian competitions historically in Oceania football competitions as well. South Melbourne's entry, I think, makes sense from a football history perspective, and certainly the ambitions of South Melbourne. So it's a little strange to see in today, but I think it goes to show just how the Pacific Islands and Oceania football generally perceive Australian football. You know, we're in close proximity to Australian football, and it has been a part of our fabric for a long time. So it's great to see South Melbourne in there.
And they'll be hosting the next round three, in about 10 days' time. You'll see how all those matches play out. But for now, Alex, thanks very much indeed for joining us on Pacific Beat. We appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Richard, and thanks for covering the competition. Cheers.
Alex Devani there, former PNG international soccer player and former Football Australia chief of staff, with his thoughts. Now the AFC Pro League is through two of the circuits, as they're called, and yeah, I think it was a tremendous win by the Solomon Kings over Auckland City, and that absolutely put a marker down. And of course, after the Australian round, which will be next, round four will be in Honiara, and you would hope Solomon Kings' momentum will be building and some decent crowds will turn out to watch.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Each week, Politalk dives straight into the tough questions, like what happens if a World War II shipwreck ruptures and unleashes thousands of litres of oil into our ocean.
Across the Pacific, there's around 3,800 of these World War II shipwrecks which are potentially polluting.
On Politalk, Tuesdays, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, worth a listen, delving into the politics of the Pacific, which is always an interesting topic and much favoured on this particular program, which is Pacific Beat. I'm Richard Hewitt, your host for this Monday morning. Sunday, should you be on the other side of the international dateline, we're going to continue on a sporting theme with the news of the World Rugby Sevens series, because after four rounds, Fiji are still 4 points clear at the top of the standings. Victory over their closest rival, South Africa, in the grand final in Perth would have doubled that lead. But in the end, after a seesaw affair, it was the Blitzbox who came out on top by just 2 points.
Now the injection of pace. Oosthuizen, Nanduvalo, forget the chase.
And on the back end of it, Nanduvalo is just so smooth across the deck. He is absolutely playing gold standard at the moment, Nanduvalo.
Deva changing the direction of the attack. Late for Bailawa. Bailawa
dummies and goes himself. Then he hits the gas. He is gone for Fiji.
He's laid to help get this raid started. Over to
the enforcer. Oosthuizen has beaten three.
Absorbs one, runs over two, gets rid of three, and in the fourth, that is absolutely brutal running from Oosthuizen. Oh, yeah, come on.
South Africa and Duarte to reclaim the lead. 10 in from touch. He's hit it well. He's nailed it. For the first time in a long time, South Africa are cup winners in Australia. Fiji's comeback lands just a couple short.
21-19, the final score. And in the women's event, the two-way battle between New Zealand and Australia continues, with New Zealand winning the gold medal this time with a 29-7 victory in the final. Fijiana remain in a perilous position, to be honest, in seventh on the ladder. They might get caught up in a relegation tussle if they carry on like that, but at least they finished the tournament on a high, winning their playoff over Great Britain by 41-5. And in rugby league, the PNG effect didn't work its magic this time for the London Broncos in their Challenge Cup encounter against Bradford. The Kummels' Finlay Glare did score the opening try, and the Broncos led the Bulls 8-4 at half-time at the Cherry Red Records Stadium, as it's called. But after the break, the Super League side rather ran away with things, taking the match to win by 26-8. So a bit of a reality check, I guess, for the London Broncos, but good to see one of the PNG contingents still on the board. We wait to see now what they do in the home and away contest. They won their first match in that against Oldham a week ago. And holding the front page for us on this Monday morning is Finau Fanua. Good morning, Finau.
Good morning.
A report from the World Health Organization has come up with a staggering 98.5% figure of adults aged 18 to 69 in Fiji have at least one risk factor for non-communicable diseases.
Yes, that's correct. FBC News reports that this World Health Organization report also found nearly half of respondents had three or more risk factors for non-communicable diseases. This was with a survey, And as you said, a staggering 98.5% of adults aged 18 to 69 have at least one risk factor for NCDs. NCDs are driven not only by individual behavior, but also by food systems, according to this report. And one of the recommendations is that investing less than $1 per person each year in proven prevention measures could significantly reduce deaths and long-term healthcare costs. Fiji's Ministry of Health has acknowledged the report and says they've strengthened primary healthcare and ramped up screening for early detection.
We're also hearing reports from French Polynesia. We were talking to the president the other day about cocaine busts. Another one, yes.
This time it's half a ton of cocaine, and it was discovered by custom officials at Papeete Port, that's in Tahiti. There's not too much detail around this seizure, except according to what the High Commission of the Republic in French Polynesia is saying, and that's it. This cocaine load was found on board a container bound for Australia, and this is the third major cocaine bust. I believe we've heard within the space of a week, we had those two vessels with over 4 tons of cocaine found on each of those vessels.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how the police and customs deal with that in French Polynesia, whether they'll just dump the stuff like they did previously and send the guys who may or may not be responsible away. We shall see. Now, Cook Islands, concerns there after a death from dengue fever.
The Cook Islands News reports that health authorities have reported the first dengue fever-related death of a current outbreak. And the health ministry says an elderly patient with underlying conditions was the victim, died in hospital last week. And it's prompted health authorities to launch what they call Operation Namu 26, and that's increasing block spraying on affected islands to kill the mosquitoes. Secretary of Health Bob Williams said the elderly patient was presented late at hospital, and so encouraged everyone to seek urgent medical attention if they experience flu-like symptoms, such as headaches and joints and muscle pains and so forth. But dengue fever outbreaks common during this time of the year.
Hopefully the situation doesn't deteriorate any further, but dengue fever death will always set the alarm bells ringing around the Pacific. That's an update of some of the stories making headlines on this Monday morning. For now, thank you very much.
Richard.
And we're going to continue on a sporting theme again now, because it's Super Bowl Sunday in the United States. The United States is a day behind in so many ways these days. The day regarded by millions of Americans as the highlight of the sporting year. This year, the showdown in the grand final of the National Football League will feature the New England Patriots taking on the Seattle Seahawks, with the game set to kick off in, less than 3 hours from now. In fact, as is often the case, both sides have players with Islander heritage on their rosters, including the Seahawks running back George Helani, one of 11 children born to Tongan parents in New Zealand. He went on to hone his skills at Sir John Bosco High School in Los Angeles County, California, before hitting the college circuit with Boise State Broncos in Idaho. Now he's poised to reach the pinnacle of his football career, a result which his school principal, that's Sir John Bosco, Ernest Antonelli, says is down to hard work and in more ways than one.
He was an amazing student. I was his Algebra 2 teacher and honors pre-calc teacher. And as a young person, he came to me after Algebra 2 and said, I really want to take the honors pre-calc class. And I said, well, yeah, you can, but be prepared to have a C. And he said, well, no. And I said, okay, well, then don't take the class. It's okay. Because that's not what I meant. He said, I'm not going to get a C in your class. I said, okay, well, it's a hard class, you know, and you have to work hard at it. Sure enough, I think he was I will remember George forever just because he's one of the hardest working students I've ever had. Came to school early when he had questions about an assignment. Never left anything unfinished, just an amazing kid. And I'm sure that he approaches everything in his life that way. That's how he ended up in the NFL.
And that brings me to next question about that attitude, that approach, striving to be the best. Does it give you a lot of pride when you see a former student of yours doing so well?
For sure. I've been a teacher at the school for 36 years, and I have quite a few students that I am close to that I stay in contact with, and they're successful in all sorts of facets in the world, not just athletes. But George stands out as well as one of those, just because his approach. He's kind to people. He's genuine. He always gives his best, and I think those are attributes that make the place he is at better. And that's what George does. I think he's just I'm sure he is an asset to the entire Seahawks organization.
And his Pacific Island heritage, could you describe that? Did he keep that to himself, or was that on display at your school?
Yeah, well, so he invited me to watch. He was part of the rugby program. And I said, I don't know anything about rugby. And he explained a little bit about it, invited me to some of the competitions. And I was really impressed because he explained a lot of, I think there's a lot of cultural pieces that go with rugby. And he explained a lot of that stuff to friends and to teachers as well. He had a great deal of pride. And I think it shows.
Last question. Who are you supporting, and who do you think is going to win the Super Bowl, Seahawks or Patriots?
Okay, I'm supporting the Seahawks 100%, and I don't, I appreciate football and sports and stuff, but I'm supporting the Seahawks just because George's on that team, and I will always be a fan of my students.
A fan of his students, and I'm sure he'll be a huge fan of that one particular student if it all goes well in the Super Bowl later this morning. Our time, Seattle Seahawks up against the New England Patriots, and we wish George Helani every success flying the flag for Tonga in the Super Bowl. I'm not quite sure how many players there are on both sides with the Islander heritage, but there'll certainly be more than a few. Of course, there are enormous numbers of players in American football rosters. 70-something, I think. I don't know how many they have floating around on the pitch during the game. I have to admit, I'm no expert on the subject, but it is a great day, and I'm wondering who's doing the halftime show, because that costs absolutely millions, doesn't it? Millions and millions. Oh, I'm told it's Bad Bunny. Well, there you go. He won a few Grammys last week, didn't he? So now he can go out there and raise a few dollars as well for all the advertisers who pay a fortune to feature during the show at halftime in the Super Bowl. And then it kicks off in about 2 and a bit hours from now. So no doubt further details here on ABC Radio Australia and the ABC more generally throughout the day. And we're just about at the end of Pacific Beats for this Monday morning. Just a reminder of the big story coming out of Fiji is gathering pressure really on Prime Minister Sitiveti Rabuka to stand down. This after the courts ruled that he had acted illegally in putting pressure on the president to remove the head of FICAC, and opposition we expect will be gathering their numbers over the coming days. They don't have the numbers to defeat the Prime Minister in a vote of no confidence if it comes to that, but maybe one or two of the on the government side might just look to their conscience. We shall see. Pacific Beat will return at 5 past 5 PNG time this afternoon, and the morning edition will be along tomorrow morning at 5 past 6 PNG time. Hope you can join us then. I believe Aggie will be back. I'm Richard Hewitt. Thanks very much indeed for your company. Enjoy the rest of your day, and if you're watching the Super Bowl, I hope that your side wins.